Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Narayanam namaskritya. Narayanam namaskritya. Narayanam namaskritya. Naram chaiva narottamam. Naram chaiva narottamam. Naram chaiva narottamam. Narayanam namaskritya. Naram chaiva narottamam. Devim sarasvatim vyasam. Devim sarasvatim vyasam. Devim sarasvatim vyasam. Tato jayam udirayat. Tato jayam udirayat. Tato jayam udirayat. Devim sarasvatim vyasam. Tato jayam udirayat. Narayanam namaskritya. Naram chaiva narottamam. Devim sarasvatim vyasam. Tato jayam udirayat. Narayanam. The personality of Godhead. Namakritya. After offering respectful obeisances. So this word namakritya means like, you know, now you've done this. So kritya is like doing or offering obeisances, but in the sense that it's being used, it means now that you're doing this, you should do something else. So Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur discusses it, and he connects it with the words tato jayam. So he's saying, okay, now after you offer obeisances to the Supreme Lord and to all these personalities he mentioned in this verse, then you should call out Jai. Yeah? So he's saying when you study the Bhagavatam, you after reading the Bhagavatam, you call out Jai. Because Jai means victory. Yeah? And the Bhagavatam is meant for achieving victory. But what does it mean? We win the football match? No, it means we actually gain victory over material desires. We gain victory over material nature by applying the Bhagavatam in our life. Because the Bhagavatam, as we read also, there's another verse where it talks about how this Bhagavat Purana is brilliant as the sun, Puranako Dinodidha, has risen just after the departure of Lord Krishna of his own abode, accompanied by knowledge, religion, etc. And it says, persons who have lost their vision due to the dense darkness of ignorance in this age of Kali shall get light from this Bhagavat Purana. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is actually the means whereby we can actually understand the nature of ourselves, the nature of God, and the process of devotional service. So therefore, we read the Bhagavatam, we call that Jai, because we achieve victory through studying the Bhagavatam. Narang. Narang Chaiva. And Narayana Rishi. Nara Uttamam. The supermost human being. Devim, the goddess. Sarasvatim, the mistress of learning. Vyasam, Vyasadev. Tata, thereafter. Jayam, all that is meant for conquering. Udirayet, be announced. Translation. Before reciting this Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the very means of conquest, one should offer respectful obeisances unto the personality of Godhead, Narayan, unto Nara Narayana Rishi, the supermost human being, unto Mother Saraswati, the goddess of learning, and unto Srila Vyasadeva, the author. Responsively, please. Before reciting this Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the very means of conquest, one should offer respectful obeisances unto the personality of Godhead Narayan, unto Nara Narayana Rishi, the supermost human being.
Unto
Mother Saraswati,
the
goddess of learning.
And unto Srila
Vyasadeva,
the author.
So this is a very important chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and probably one of the most important, well, at least in my experience, one of the most important chapters. You could probably learn every single verse in this chapter and be able to use them constantly in your preaching and classes, etc., because they're all very important verses. And we see that in the previous chapter, the sages at Namishwaranya were asking Suta Goswami various questions. And now Suta Goswami, before answering these questions, he's doing what you call a Mangalacharan, which is basically, you know, offering obeisances to the Guru, glorifying the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And here, in this verse, is particularly interesting. This is, in deity worship, there's many different mantras we use. And all these mantras, they have a chanda or a meter by which they are chanted. There's also a devata, or the personality who is worshipped by that mantra, or the deity of that mantra. And then there's also the rishi, or the person who perfected themselves by chanting that mantra. So this is like a Vinayoga mantra. Because we see here that he's offering obeisances to Narayan. So what's the significance of Narayan in relation to the Srimad Bhagavatam? Where did Vyasadeva compile the Srimad Bhagavatam? At least the first nine cantos. Bhadrak Ashram, which is, Narayan is the predominating deity there in Bhadrak Ashram. So he's the devata of this mantra. Narayan is the devata. Do you know where he compiled the 10th canto? What's the 10th canto about? So where would he do that? Yes, not Melbourne. In Vrindavan. And there's actually, when you go on the Parikram Mark, the cowherd trail around Vrindavan, when you're going on the south side of the temple, you know, and just as you start to come back towards Krishna Balaram, you know, like you turn back towards the temple, and before you cross over the Mathura Road, there's a little temple there, not really a temple, but a small monument, you might say. Where Vyas is offering his obeisances, like a small boy, and he's offering his obeisances to Krishna. He's like prostrated obeisances with his hands outstretched in the direction of Krishna. So that's supposedly where he compiled the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So then here we see that the rishi is Narayana Rishi. So he's offering glorification. The devata is Narayan. The rishi is Vyas, because he's the one who perfected himself through compiling the Bhagavatam. And that's, and then the chanda, the meter, what would the meter be? In the first verse of the Bhagavatam, what does it say? What's the one word there particularly, which Prabhupada says indicates a particular mantra? Dimahi. Dimahi, exactly, very good. He's pointing out that predominantly the meter of the Bhagavatam is the Gayatri. This is according to Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. It's not my own creation. So he's saying that predominantly the meter is the Gayatri. And then also it's indicating Shakti being Saraswati and Bija, Om, because the very first word of the invocation in Bhagavatam is Om. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So the very first word is Om, so it's indicating a bija. So this mantra is offering glorification, but this is what a Vinayoga mantra does. It establishes the personalities that should be remembered when we're chanting these mantras. So in the same way, you'll see that many devotees, when they give Bhagavatam class, they start Narayanam Namaskritam Narangajayavan Namatam Devim Saraswati Mbisam Tatojayam Nasta Prayasabhadrishu Nitram Bhagavate Sevaya. They start off with these two mantras. So they're offering glorification. When Srila Prabhupada, he gave class on the second verse in this chapter, he's saying that actually this is that one should be offering obeisance as a spiritual master before they speak on Shastra. And we see in the second verse, what does Sukha Goswami do? He offers his respects to Sukadeva Goswami, who's his spiritual master. He heard the Bhagavatam from Sukadeva Goswami. So Sukadeva Goswami, not an ordinary personality. Not at all an ordinary personality. Because we see that even though his mother was impregnated, that Sukadeva Goswami, he remained within the womb for 16 years. Because he felt that he wasn't ready to come out. He wasn't, you know, because we see that when Sukadeva Goswami, when he was born, immediately he left home. So he was waiting until he was sufficiently, he felt that he was sufficiently realized, advanced in God realization, so that he could just go engage himself in devotional service and meditate upon the Supreme Lord and propagate God consciousness. So after 16 years in the womb, then he decided to leave and, you know, take birth, leave and just go and become absorbed in the process of Krishna consciousness. So, as I mentioned, in the previous chapter, the first chapter, the sages in Namashranya, they're asking six questions. And in this chapter here, Sutta Goswami will set out about answering those different questions. And he does it by bringing into the discussion here, or into the storyline, the discussion that Sukadeva Goswami had on the bank of the Ganges when Parikshit Maharaj came and he was asking him questions. And we see with the Bhagavatam, it's kind of stories within stories within stories. You know, someone will ask him a question, Parikshit will ask him a question and say, it's very interesting you asked this question because at such and such a time, in such and such a place, so and so asked Narad Muni this question. And then he goes into the whole story. Like we see this in the seventh canto, for instance, that is extensively, there's four chapters where it's extensively quoting discussion between Narad Muni and Yudhisthira Maharaj, where Yudhisthira was asking about the duties of a king. And then we see this discussion between Maitreya and Uddhava. There's so many different discussions there. So this is how he answers the Bhagavatam. He explains the Bhagavatam. It's through quoting all these various authorities, and this is actually a means whereby we establish the conclusions in spiritual circles. It's not, in my opinion. We don't do that. Only one person has the right to say that. Who's that person? Krishna. He says, me mataha to Arjuna. He says, this is my opinion. No one's going to argue with Krishna's opinion. But if I sit here and say, well, in my opinion, the Bhagavatam is saying this, that, and the other thing, well, you're going to say, who is this guy? Yeah. And there was one time when one of Prabhupada's sannyas disciples, he was sitting on the speaker's asana, he was giving Bhagavatam class, and he was quoting all these strange stories. And Srila Prabhupada stopped and he said, what is this nonsense? Speak Srimad Bhagavatam. So that the point is that we need to speak that which is given by the acharyas. But we're not interested in a person's opinion because the thing is, we're all fallible, conditioned living entities. What do we know? But the acharyas, they're actually liberated personalities. They're actually not subject to the various defects. They don't have imperfect senses. They don't make mistakes. They don't cheat. They're not in illusion. And we hear that Chaya Dosha Shodi, where Bhaktivinoda Thakur is praying to please free me from the six kinds of imperfections, or six doshas, the faults. He's asking the Lord to free him from the six faults. So a conditioned living entity is actually subject to these various faults. Therefore, it's just like, you use the example of coloured glasses. Years ago I was given a pair of Vornay driving glasses. They're French glasses, they're quite good. And the thing is, they're yellow. They're for driving, in bright sunlight. They're yellow. And somehow or other, because they're yellow, it softens for the eyes, it softens the glare of the sun. But the thing is, like, when you wear these sunglasses, driving glasses, because they're yellow, everything looks yellow. Huh? Everything. Even green and blue and red, they all look yellow. So I use this as an analogy to indicate how, because we're conditioned, then we are looking at everything in the material world through a particular type of filter. Just like a lusty person, whenever he or she sees an attractive person, someone who's attractive to them, then they think of how to enjoy that person. A greedy person, or someone who's after wealth, whenever they see something, they'll see, how can I make money from this? That's because of the conditioning. That's because the filter, they're viewing the material nature. They're seeing the material nature as a means for their sense gratification, as a means to enjoy. But someone who's actually Krishna conscious, when they look at the material nature, they see, oh, how can I use this to serve Krishna? They see it in relation to Krishna. That's the difference between a materialistic person and a Krishna conscious person. There's an interesting story. I remember Hari Kesh Prabhu, when he was a sannyasi, he visited here in Melbourne, and he told this story here, how he was with Prabhupada one time, and he was, because Hari Kesh was, as I understand, I mean, I may be telling the story incorrectly, but as I understand, he was describing to Prabhupada how he's feeling some agitation. And Prabhupada quoted some different, he quoted a story of Yudhisthira Maharaj, and Krishna was asking Yudhisthira, because Kunti was very, very beautiful, extraordinarily beautiful. She was actually desired by the demigods. Surya and different demigods, they came and actually impregnated her, gave her children. She was so beautiful that they had that desire. Anyhow, so Krishna was asking Yudhisthira, he said, your mother is so beautiful, I mean, doesn't this bother you at all? And, because Prabhupada was trying to impress upon Hari Kesh that, you just have to tolerate these things. And Yudhisthira responded, he says, yes, I can see that. I can see that she's very beautiful, but I just do nothing. I don't think about it. I just do nothing. And then Prabhupada goes on, and at that time, like this beautiful, a wife member and his beautiful young wife had come in. And Prabhupada, he said, and just see, this young woman, I can see she's very beautiful. I am not blind. And this woman's kind of cringing, why Swami, she's sort of pointing me out like this. And she says, but I can see this, but what do? I do nothing. So this is the point, we can see that someone who's transcendental, someone who's spiritually fixed, can actually, they see these things in material nature and they don't try to exploit it. But someone who's not on this platform just sees material nature as a means of exploitation. How can I exploit this? What benefit can I get from this? And in doing this, they actually implicate themselves further and further. Because as we understand, Rupa Goswami explains the effect of material desires, how we have this karma, this desire to enjoy, and then it manifests, it generates a seed, and from the seed becomes an activity, from the activity comes this papam, the sin, and then this causes parabdha and aparabdha karma. So one manifests and one is unmanifest, and then from this aparabdha, this unmanifest karma, it develops into a seed stage, and again fructifies as activity. But also along with that, going into this seed-like stage, it also increases one's proclivity to act in that way. So, whenever we do something that is impious or sinful, essentially sinful means anything that's not directed at Krishna, anything that's against the tenets of Krishna consciousness. Whenever we do something simple, I'm not trying to use heavy words or anything, it's just a very simple definition. Whenever we do something that is considered sinful, it weakens our resolve to follow regular principles. It weakens our resolve to increase our Krishna consciousness. So it behooves one on the spiritual path to be very resolute in their determination. And just like we see that Krishna explains to Arjuna in the Gita, I think it's that verse Vyavasakam Buddha, Eke He Kurunandana, Bahu Shakahinantascha, Buddhyo Vyavasayanam. So saying that person who's on this path who is Eke He, this one point of attention. If we have this one point of attention to worship Krishna, then we become resolute in our purpose. So it's easy. If we can have this one point of attention. But it says, Bahu Shaka. Bahu means many. Shaka, branches. Bahu Shaka Inantashya, Buddhyo Vyavisayana. One who has many purposes, many focuses, is irresolute in their purpose. And therefore, for them, Krishna consciousness is very difficult. So the goal is to have this one point of determination to serve Krishna. This one point of determination to, sorry, Mahatmaji. This one point of determination to, progress on the path of devotional service. And in that way, we gain strength from that. We gain this ability to control our mind, to control our senses. But if we're constantly allowing all these other things to come in, then it weakens our determination. So it's a very important lesson, I think, to learn. So we see here, as I was mentioning in this chapter, that Suta Goswami, he's praying to Sukadev, his spiritual master, to please bless him. And actually, there's a really interesting, in one of the previous verses, I didn't bring my glasses, I'm sorry, so I can't see this so well. Really interesting. It says Sava Bhuta Hridayam Munim. So this is addressing Sukadeva Munim. He's addressing Sukadeva Goswami. And not Muni in the traditional sense. He's what we might call a Stitta Dhir Muni, one who's fixed in their consciousness. Because Muni generally means, because Narada Muni is also addressed as a Stitta Dhir Muni. Muni generally means, as it says in the Yasha Rishi, what is it? Yasha Rishi Matam Bibinam in the Mahabharata. How a Muni is known because his opinion differs from another. So there's so many Munis, they're all speculating on so many different conclusions. But that's not the type of Muni that's being discussed here. And this is discussing Sukadeva Goswami, who's a Muni whose consciousness is fixed on Krishna. Completely fixed on Krishna. So he's saying here, Sava Bhuti Mridayam Munam. He's saying that how Sukadeva Goswami, he's actually entered into the mind of all the Sarva Buddha, all the living entities. Well, this Buddha, Hridayam means heart, mind, consciousness. It's all synonymous, it's kind of the same thing. Sometimes Hridayam means heart, sometimes it means consciousness. Also, there's a word, Chitta, same. It's used sort of interchangeably for these different things, so it's indicating the same thing. So he's saying here how Sukadeva Goswami has entered into the hearts and minds or the consciousness of all living entities. And Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur points out that he's also glorifying Sukadeva Goswami. He's asking him to please you enter into my consciousness, and so you speak the Bhagavatam through me. Because he's realizing his lack of qualification. I mean, he's actually a very qualified person. I'm not saying that he's not qualified, but he's his own thought. And this is the consciousness of a greatly advanced devotee. He's thinking that I am nothing. Everyone else is a great Vaishnava, but me, I'm insignificant. I'm just a demon. This is the consciousness of great Vaishnavas. They're thinking themselves unqualified. Because if we think ourselves qualified, that's a symptom of pride. And if we have pride, that's going to be an anartha to actually realizing the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And we see, when the gopis had pride, what happened? Krishna disappeared from them. At the rasa dance, he left because of pride. So we see in the same way that Baladeva Vidyabhushan, when he went to Golta and he prayed to Govindadev to please, you manifest this commentary. He wrote the Govinda Bhashya. You manifest this through me. He wasn't considering himself qualified to speak on the philosophy. So he prayed to Govindadev, you please manifest before me. As a homage or as an acceptance of Govindadev's manifestation in a form of mercy, he called his commentary Govindabhasya. As an acknowledgement that this is the words of Govindadev. And he wrote it in such a short time. So in the same way we see here, Vyas, he wrote this Bhagavatam non-stop. Interesting pastime that Vyas was asked by Narada to write this down, because he's expressing his lamentation that he'd divided the Vedas, written the Upanishads, etc., but he's feeling dissatisfaction. And then Narada pointed out, he said, this is because you have failed to glorify the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You failed to focus. Because he wants the same one point of attention on the Personality of Godhead. Because as it says, yenatma supersedeti. One will actually supersede, one will become satisfied if we actually focus upon the pastimes of Krishna. Because we're focusing on these mundane pastimes, we're focusing on anything else. And if you analyze the Vedas are meant for different types of men. For men in mode of passion, for men in mode of ignorance, for men in mode of goodness. It's not aimed at the transcendentalists exclusively. Whereas the Srimad Bhagavatam is exclusively aimed at the transcendentalist. It's actually, you know, it's called the Amal Purana. It's Sattvata Purana. It's meant for the Sattvatas. The Sattvatas are those who are beyond the modes of nature, modes of material nature. So, Narad Muni revealed this to Vyasadeva, that, you know, he was feeling dissatisfaction because he had not elaborated the Srimad Bhagavatam. But then upon elaborating the Srimad Bhagavatam, by writing down the Srimad Bhagavatam, then he became satisfied. So this Bhagavatam is such an important literature, and this is like the beginning. This chapter here is like the beginning of the Bhagavatam. And this chapter is very interesting. Again, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur points out that... I didn't finish that point I was making here about this Sarva Bhutarida Mayam. Just as Sudra Goswami is praying to Sukadeva Goswami, because Sukadeva Goswami, he actually appeared for the specific purpose of narrating the Srimad Bhagavatam. So he's like the personification of the Srimad Bhagavatam. He's the living Srimad Bhagavatam. And actually, it's said that there's two types of Bhagavat. There's the book Bhagavat and the person Bhagavat. And one should hear the book Bhagavat from the person Bhagavat. So then before we start reading Bhagavatam, Vishnava Chakravarti Thakur, before we start speaking on Bhagavatam, Vishnava Chakravarti Thakur makes the point that we should actually pray to Sukadeva Goswami to please become present in my consciousness so that you speak the Bhagavatam. Because he is the person Bhagavatam. And so in this way we see that, you know, all these great personalities, they're not considering themselves to be qualified to present Shastra Nakas, they're actually considering themselves very formal. And they're praying for the mercy of the great personalities. And we see, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, he's praying for the mercy of Sukadeva Goswami. Even though he himself is the most qualified personality, highly qualified. But he's still considering that he's not qualified. And this is one of their many qualifications, is they don't think they're qualified. Because as soon as we start to think we're qualified, that means we're not qualified. Yeah? If you follow that logic. Because it means we have pride. I think there's a famous, philosophy from René Descartes. I think is how you say his name. I don't know how to say French words. I'm born in Australia, I don't know stuff like that. Anyhow, his philosophy is, I think, therefore I am. And so it's all based on his false ego. That's the first thing. I think, therefore I am. But a Vaishnava doesn't think like that. A Vaishnava is always, as we see here, it's being clearly demonstrated by Sutta Goswami. His first thing is he's offering obeisances to the Guru. He's offering obeisances to the Parampara. He's offering obeisances to the great personalities. The Rishi, who perfected himself by this, the Gayatri Mantra, the Chanda, the Mita that is chanted by, the Devata, the goddess Saraswati. And we see Arjuna, he did exactly the same thing. Yeah? At the end of the Gita, what did he say? He says, Tvat prasadat maya chuta. By your mercy, I'm understanding. He didn't say, oh yeah, because I've got a PhD in yoga and all this kind of religious studies and stuff, now I understand. Yeah, I'm a really intelligent guy. But yet we see so many people like that. The first thing they say when you meet you is who they are, what their qualifications are. Yeah? This is the manifestation of their false ego. No, but what does Arjuna say? He says, by your mercy, I understand my position. Therefore, what does he say? Karashe vachanam tava. Therefore, I'll act according to your instructions. So, even though Arjuna is a very, very qualified person, highly qualified, he's so qualified that he got this, you know, had such a relationship with Krishna, as Krishna was his intimate friend. He would sit on the same bed as Krishna. He would have arguments with Krishna. Now, this is all described in the first canto of the Bhagavatam. such a highly qualified person. Yet still, he's saying, by your mercy and understanding. So this is the mood of great Vaishnavas. So just to elaborate a little bit about this chapter, not so much, but just discuss a little bit of this chapter. This chapter is primarily, there's three things that are discussed in this chapter. We'll see as it develops. The first thing is the process of devotional service, abhideya, bhakti. It's talking about the process. And we'll see in the subsequent verses, very nicely elaborated, different aspects of the process. Then it talks about the goal, prayojana, prema. Talks about, what is the goal of devotional service. And you see some really nice verses coming up that, that get into this quite, in verse 6 it starts to talk about the goal of the process. It says, sāve pumsam paro dhammo, dharma, the process. Yato bhakti rahakshaje, very nice verses. And then we've got the process, the goal. And then of course it talks about Krishna, the object of worship. In this verse already, it's mentioned the Raya, Krishna. So it discusses those three things. I didn't, because I only got asked like 10 minutes before class started. I wanted to actually read through the previous chapter to see if the focus, because it led me to believe that possibly the focus of the previous chapter would have been Sambandha. Because in the Vedas, Mahaprabhu points out that the Vedas only have three topics: Sambandha, Avideya, Prayoja. That's it. So it would seem to me logical that this is the Srimad Bhagavatam is an exposition of the Vedas, therefore it would follow that order. So it would seem to me logical. I mean, I didn't have a chance to read it, so I can't really say that clearly. But it would seem to me logically that the first chapter would primarily be focusing on Sambandha, if this chapter is then focusing on Abhideya and Prayojana. Okay. And then, of course, it discusses Krishna, the object of worship. So it's just a few thoughts on that. I'll read Srila Prabhupada's purport. All the Vedic literature and Puranas are meant for conquering the darkest region of material existence. See this word, jayam, conquer. Yeah? Tata, jayam. Therefore, by this Bhagavatam, we can actually conquer the darkest regions of material existence. We need to understand how significant this scripture is. It's not just a book that tells some nice stories. This is the most important literature. Mahaprabhu presented this thing as being the Amala Purana, the spotless Purana. If you go through the other Puranas, you'll see there's so many what may appear to be discrepancies there to a conditioned soul. But this is the spotless Purana because why? Because it focuses on the spotless personalities, Krishna and his servants. This Bhagavat Purana, as I was saying before, it's as brilliant as the sun. Persons have lost their ignorance due to the dense darkness of this age. And just look at what's going on around us in this world. It's getting darker and darker and darker every single day. The world is becoming more and more difficult to live. Just take a few mundane examples. I mean, look what's happening with the stock market. It's up and down like a seesaw. And they're hoping and praying, that it's going to become stable, but it's not going to. There's an interesting expression in Australia which I find very amusing, When someone's enjoying themselves and, they think this is really good, they think, it doesn't get any better than this. And I think that's a fact, it doesn't. It's all downhill. That's the nature of the material world. You may get some enjoyment in this material world, but it's flickering. Kamala dala dala jivana talamala. It's just like Lord Chandas Thakur describes. It's just like a drop of water hanging on a lotus. So up at New Govardhan, anyone who's been to New Govardhan, there's two lakes at New Govardhan. So the smaller one up the top is called Govinda Kund. The large one's called Manasi Ganga, isn't it? Yeah. So the big one down the bottom. But up in Govinda Kund, there's lotuses growing there. And you can see, like in the summer, because it rains quite a lot in the summer up there, when the lotus leaves, they come up in full, the flowers are full bloom and it rains. And what happens is because they're shaped like that, right, the lotus leaf fills up with water, right? And then when it fills up, it goes like that, dumps all the water, comes back up, empty. So it's so precarious, The leaf goes over like that, the water's all gone. So that's the point that Lord Chandas Thakur was making, is that it's just hanging like a drop of water in a lotus. That's our position in this material world, hanging like a drop of water. We may be so great, so powerful, in the estimation of ordinary people. Big, big position. We may have the second richest company in the world, the second most powerful company in the world. There's a famous example of someone right now. Right? He's just had to retire from his position because he's got some terminal disease. Big, big, powerful man, so much money. You know, he makes decisions that can change the way that everyone uses the technology. But just one small thing, it's finished. You know, look, you know, earthquakes, tsunamis, just one sort of small flex in the material nature's muscle. And thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people, their lives are changed forever. It's so precarious in this world. And the Bhagavatam helps us to see that. The Bhagavatam helps us to see the nature of this world, helps us to see the nature of the material body, helps us to see the nature, the true nature of the soul. It describes these things very clearly. So if we take shelter of the Bhagavatam, and we take shelter of the perfect personalities representing the Bhagavatam, then we'll also come to understand this. The living being is in a state of forgetfulness of his relationship with God, to his being overly attracted, due. See, without glasses it's getting hard. See, this is the temporary nature. I used to think I had very good eyes. I could read a sign, you know, like hundreds of feet away. I could read a small writing. Now I can't even read the Bhagavatam right in front of my face. So it's just, you know, even though it's frustrating, we need to see these things and see the temporary nature of this material body, the temporary nature, the flickering, transitory nature of this material world. And understand it. Really accept that, you know, well, okay, we see it happening to other people. We see how they're experiencing all these things. But the fact is, one time Prabhupada, he was in Bhagavatam class, he was talking about this, and he hang up his arm, and he's like, you know, when you get older, how your skin hangs down like that. He says, just see, flat tire. He said, don't think this won't happen to you. Because it will. It will happen to every single one of us. You know, four things you're guaranteed of in this world: birth, death, old age, disease. Nothing else is guaranteed. No guarantee of happiness, no guarantee of wealth. No guarantee. Only those four things are guaranteed. Lovely place, isn't it? So due to his being overly attracted to material sense gratification from time immemorial, his struggle for existence in the material world is perpetual, and it is not for him to get out of it by making plans. The thing is, people are making so many plans. They think they're going to be happy. They build it, you know, Prabhupada says, they build houses like they think they're going to last forever, like they're never going to die. Just drive down Beaconsfield Parade through Brighton, have a look at the houses on the left hand side. Gigantic things, you know, with fountains and palm trees and, you know, this thing and that thing. You know, they build these houses like they think they're never ever going to die. But the fact is, everyone does. So we need to know that. If he at all wants to conquer this perpetual struggle for existence, he must re-establish his eternal relation with God. And one who wants to adopt such remedial measures must take shelter of literatures such as the Vedas and the Puranas. Foolish people say that the Puranas have no connection with the Vedas. However, the Puranas are supplementary explanations of the Vedas intended for different types of men. Because sometimes people dismiss the Bhagavatam as being unimportant, because it's one of the Puranas, the Bhagavat Purana. All men are not equal. Another very interesting point, because, you know, sometimes people will say to us, oh, we're all equal. But that's not a fact. You know? Am I equal to you? No, you're far greater than I am. Huh? More intelligent, much more handsome. Huh? We're all different. We all have different capacities. You know, some of us can run very fast, some can't. Some are very strong. You know, some aren't. Some of us are in ladies' bodies, some are in men's bodies. Is that equal? How could that be possible? I can't have a baby. How could that be possible? Is it such a foolish thing to say that we're all equal? Actually, one time that someone was saying that to Prabhupada, there was a woman's lip that was saying that we're all equal, and Prabhupada was just completely defeated. This is just a nonsense idea, because we're not. We're all different. In the eyes of God, we're all equal, yes. But which one of us is God? He sees us equal. And there's that story, you know, when Hanuman was throwing the mountains and huge boulders and things into the sea to build the bridge to Lanka. and there was a little spider who was throwing grains of sand. And Hanuman was saying, "Oh, you're in the way here, get out of the way, you'll get hurt." But then Ram, he said, "No, but I see his service is equal to yours." From the transcendental position, he sees that. But from the material position, you can't, you know, from material position, it's foolishness to say we're equal. Because we all have different material capacities. And as long as we are in this conditioned state, we have to see. And this is like a madhyam, sees the differences. We have to discriminate. Because as long as we're not in the liberated state, you know, if the sexes are mingling too closely, then what happens? We turn our attention to the opposite sex. Because we're not equal, we're different. We have different bodies. As long as we're seeing, as long as we're identifying materially, we have to make these discriminations. When we get past that, when we're no longer on the material platform, we're on the spiritual platform, as it says, what's that verse? Sahagunan samatityaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate. When one's actually past this identification of the most material nature, then brahma bhuyaya kalpate is situated on Brahman. Therefore they see the equality of all things. But until we get to that point, we need to discriminate. Otherwise it causes problems for us. And then Prabhupada goes on to say, all men are not equal. There are men who are conducted by the mode of goodness, others who are under the mode of passion, and others who are under the mode of goodness. The Puranas are so divided that any class of men can take advantage of them and gradually regain their lost position and get out of the hard struggle for existence. Srila Suta Goswami shows the way of chanting the Puranas. This may be followed by persons who aspire to be preachers of the Vedic literatures and the Puranas. Srimad Bhagavatam is the spotless Purana and is especially meant for them who desire to get out of the material entanglement permanently, because it deals with the transcendental subject matter. The Vedas, the Puranas, they also deal with these topics, but in a more indirect way. And as is pointed out in the Mahabharata, it says, Shruti Yogibhinna, because there's many, many different divisions in the Vedas aimed at different... There's four primary books, the Brahmas, the Aranyakas, the Upanishads, and the... Brahmanas, Aranyakas, Upanishads, I can't remember the name of the other one. And they have then been divided into many different books. Now, up to the point now, there's 132,000 different books in the Vedas. You know, because Vyasa had six prominent disciples, each of them took a segment of the Vedas, and then they divided amongst their disciples, and they divided amongst their disciples, etc., 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 till you get to the point now where there's 132,000 books. So, and only a small percentage of those are still extant. Most of those books are not available anymore. So, you know, it's so divided is one thing. And it's only if you study the whole thing you can actually understand the transcendental personality, Krishna. So, Bhagavatam is very, very important, very, very effective, because it goes straight to the root of it. Because, you know, there's no, like, flowery words in the Bhagavatam, you know, trying to make things sound really nice and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It goes straight to the root of it. You know, right in the second verse, Dharma Projita Kaita, it kicks out cheating religion. Right in the second verse, it goes straight to the, like to the jugular vein, you know? Straight to the root of it. It's like, no cheating religion here. It deals directly with the topics of Krishna. It points out who you are. You're not this body. You're spirit soul, eternal servant of Krishna. Krishna is the Supreme Lord. He is our master, and we should serve him. It's going straight to the essence of it. So that, you know, in this age of Kali, this is the most effective literature. And that's why Lord Chaitanya focused on it. That's why Srila Prabhupada gave great emphasis. All our previous acharyas gave great emphasis to it. You see, all of our acharyas, they study Bhagavatam because it's such an important literature. So this point is being made here in the Prabhupada by Srila Prabhupada, is that for someone who really wants to get out of this material entanglement, you take shelter of the Bhagavatam and hear it from a qualified personality, hear it from Prabhupada and other great personalities, or, you know, pray for Sukadeva Goswami to, as Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says, pray for Sukadeva Goswami to manifest himself within your consciousness so you can understand this book. Because by understanding this book, we will actually achieve liberation. there's that verse in Sadhu Sangam Nama Kirtan Bhagavat Shravan Maturavasa Srimatri Shari Saran. That this this talks about the five most powerful processes of devotional service, because we see in the next devotion there's 64 items of devotional service listed in chapter 5 and 6, and then I think it's chapter 7 goes on to explain, or maybe it's a little bit after them, I can't remember, that the most potent forms, the five most potent forms of devotional service is sadhu sangha, associating with devotees, because devotees, you know, they're trying to live their lives by the Bhagavatam. So we get good examples of this success. And we see, you know, when we associate with devotees, we see how devotees are developing as a result of living their lives according to the Bhagavatam, living their lives according to the previous acharyas. Saranuga Marga, Guru Padacharya Diksha Guru Sevana Saddhana Siksha Priksha Sadhu Marga Anugamana. So Sadhu Marga Anugamana, we're following the path that's given by the previous acharyas, by the previous great devotees. And then so it's Nama Kirtan, we chant the holy name. Bhagavat Shravan, we hear the Bhagavatam. Very important process, you know, it's one of the most important. Matura Vasa, live in a holy dharma such as a temple or a holy place. And Sri Murti Shri Savan, worship the deity with faith and veneration. So, you know, all our acharyas are indicating the importance of this shastra, of this literature. Mahabhu himself has indicated the importance of it. And Prabhupada gave such a large amount of his life to translating this book to make it available for us. So, you know, I'm encouraging everyone to take shelter of this book, read it every day, try to understand. It's not that we have to, you know, read the whole thing cover to cover, you know. Even if you just read the first canto, Prabhupada said everything necessary for God realization is contained in the first canto. And you see these purports in the first canto, they're so full of realization, so full of understanding. So, you know, it may be that we don't actually get through the whole Bhagavatam in our lives and, you know, fully understand it, but just, you know, every day try to read, even if it's just one verse, try to read and enter into the understanding of the verse. And in that way it'll help us to grow and develop in devotional service. Okay, thank you very much for patiently listening. Any questions? Mahatmaji.
You talk about Muni. Muni is fully fixed in the service of the Krishna. So what is the difference between Muni and Rishi? Can you elaborate on that? Muni and Rishi.
No, I can't really give any authoritative statement on it. It may be it's the same thing, I'm not sure. You'd have to ask someone who knows Sanskrit a bit better than me.
Because when we pray to Radharani, the first verse is Muni Manvandate Shokharan, you know. So where the position of Rishi comes in? You see so many Rishis, Ramayana and Bhagavad Gita,
I think there's many, you know, just as with Munis, there's different levels of Munis. So you have like a standard Muni, which is, you know, so many different opinions. Then you have like Narad Muni, a Stitadir Muni, but he's also called Narad Rishi. So it would seem, without further investigation, it would seem that they're synonymous, the same thing. Because, you know, sometimes he's called Narad Muni, sometimes he's called Narad Rishi. Yeah. It was seen as the same thing, just a different word. This one.
A few months ago, a new practicing devotee asked me a question just about what you were talking today. That these differences that we are all equal, that she was very nice. There's so much separation between men and women, and why there is less respect for the women compared to I should thought, less respect to the women, and if you're all not in the material pledge from, like, not pledge from the body, but pledge from the life, and why there's so much attention to it, and why there's so much segregation, like that. Well, I gave you an answer, but could you please refer to it?
Yeah. It's a question that does come up quite a lot. This sort of differentiation between men and women, and it definitely requires some maturity to understand. And as I was saying before, because we're identifying with the body, we need to follow certain rules that are related to the body. Like the Manusamhita are laws for the material world. The Manusamhita doesn't apply in the spiritual world. In the spiritual world, you know, people don't think they're the body. Therefore, they don't have to have the same rules of segregation. But as long as, you know, it's like, you know, a young man, young woman are naturally attracted to each other, right? And as we know, when the passions increase, discrimination tends to reduce. So before you know it, people are engaging in illicit sex. This is a result of having too much close contact. And we see it all the time in devotional service. Is, you know, people come along and they think, oh, we don't need to have these rules and regulations. We just have our association. And you wind up having people getting themselves in very compromised situations. So therefore, the rules and regulations that are there are specifically for people who think they're on the bodily platform. When one's, you know, a liberated person, one who's an Uttamadhikari, is beyond the rules and regulations. Even though we see someone like Srila Prabhupada, who was beyond the rules and regulations, because he came to preach Krishna consciousness, he himself set an example, so he followed the rules and regulations himself. Even though certainly we can understand that he wasn't agitated by material desires, for instance. He wasn't lusting over young women or whatever. Although we see there is a story where a king was asking, I think it's a Birbal story from memory. Birbal was having a discussion with Akbar, and Birbal was making the point that as long as one has the material body, then the sex desire is there. And the king was saying, no, I don't believe this, you know. So then one day Birbal said, well, don't worry, Your Majesty, I will show it to you. You just wait, I will prove this to you. So then one day he came and got the king, and he said, Your Majesty, please come and bring your young daughter. He had a very beautiful daughter. And so he said, where are we going, Birbal? He said, don't worry, Your Majesty, you will understand in due time. Just wait, please come. And so they came to this house. And he said, Your Majesty, in this house there is a man who is about to die. Now you ask you go in with your daughter, and you just watch where the gaze of the man goes. So he entered with his daughter. You know, I can't remember whether he entered first or the daughter entered first. It's not really relevant who entered first. One of them entered first and one entered second. And the thing is, as soon as the dying man, he saw the king, who obviously, you know, he's supposed to be respectful to, but as soon as he saw the girl, beautiful young girl, wasn't interested in anything else. Because that's the nature of material desires. So, because we're affected by material nature, we need to follow various rules which will help us to focus on the process of devotional service. That's all. And as far as the other point you were making, that women are treated as inferior, or they get the sense of being inferior, I conclude that that is a result of religious zealots, basically. Religious zealots, people who follow the rules and regulations very, very strictly. Because, you know, in devotional service we address all women as mother. This is the rule of Chanaka Pandit. Prabhupada often quoted Chanaka Pandit as being Shastric Injunction. He would say that these maxims of Chanaka are Shastric Injunction. So, you know, I address you as Mataji. So if I'm addressing you as Mataji, how do I see you as inferior? I don't see my own mother as inferior. That's incorrect that someone, you know, sees a woman as being inferior. No, we need to understand that men and women have different roles. That's a fact, based on the body. It's just like, you know, one person has the role of as the Prime Minister of the country, based on his qualification. Another person has a role as a street sweeper, based on their qualification. So along with the body, you know, we have men's bodies, we have women's bodies, we have children's bodies. So a different qualification comes with that body. So to discriminate on against somebody based on their body is an immature understanding. We just need to understand the body's different. That's all. So, but you know, it's kind of like there was a French band years ago. It was devoted in their Keshi Shatru. I can't remember the name of the band, but there was an interesting line in one of the songs. The song was about Kali Yuga, and in the line it said, it's all about how when the axe comes down. But it said the women all want to be the men, and the men can only remember when. So we see that in Kali Yuga, it's all mixed up. You know, women want to act like men want to act like women. They can't figure out what sex they are. They want to have sex changes. I mean, I even know devotees who have had sex changes, which is really confused. You know, they must be really confused. You know? So the Shastra is there to give us a clear understanding. Primarily, you're not this body. But as long as you think you are the body, follow the rules of Shastra. Because this will enable you, this will assist you to come to the point of understanding you're not the body. Did that clarify things at all? It can be quite a hot topic. And as long as, you know, and it's primarily that men, you know, look at women as being inferior, and it's just not correct. It's just not correct according to our philosophy. You know, did Yudhisthira tell Kunti she was inferior? Did he treat her as inferior? They worship, you know. In India, you'll often see, and it's interesting because I see this like often in ISKCON in various parts of the world, that you know, like young new brahmacharis or bhaktas, or whatever, they treat women very harshly, or you know, I've even seen them spit at women and stuff like that, which is very, you know, unnecessary, unwarranted. Yet we see that, you know, when a young Indian man will go, or even not young, you know. I mean, you know, when you go to India and see your mother, what do? You touch her feet, right? You ask any Indian man here what they do is they touch the feet of their mother. Now, you do that to someone who you think is inferior? So that's the culture. But that's not that should just be applied to our own mother. Because there's six mothers: Atma Mata, Guru Patni, Brahmani Patni, Rajika, Deno Dati Tapri, Saptate Mata. It says there's seven mothers. Atma Mata, one's own mother, the wife of the guru. Brahmani, the wife of the guru, the brahmana. The wife of the king. The cow, the nurse of the earth. Yeah? So we should see all these personalities as mother. And the role of the mother is we respect. I mean, the relationship is respect. We respect the mother. And so all these personalities should be respected. This is culture. But just to behave in some, you know, misogynistic fashion is not culture. We don't see that in Vedic culture. Where is the story in the Veda or the Purana or the Mahabharata where a cultured person has said to a woman, "You're inferior," or treated her in such a way? I don't know of any stories like that. Okay. Grantara, oh, David?
I just really appreciate as a woman how you responded to the question. And also, I find that the AM is going to treat me very well. So that's something I like to move forward because my personal experience is the men are just so loving and affectionate. And that's something I feel very grateful as a woman. So in that sense, one of the experiences is more different, even though there's a difference of gender. So it's quite good.
You just reminded me of a Prabhupada story. One time in Mayapur, one of the ladies came to Prabhupada. Because, you see, we have to understand it's two-sided. It's not just the men are treating women badly. You have to understand there's two sides to the coin. One time one of the ladies came to Prabhupada and he complained to Prabhupada, you know, the men, they're not treating the women like mother. They're treating us very badly. So something's been going on for some time in this con. And Prabhupada responded, I think he wasn't very happy. But Prabhupada responded, he said, yes, and neither are the men are not treating the women like mother, but neither are the women acting like mother. And so we have to keep this in mind. If a woman is acting, I could use a harsh word, but I'd rather not. If a woman is acting in a way that is sexually provocative, that is not acting like mother. That is acting like prostitute. So the men should not be acting sexually provocative, trying to attract the women. Neither should the women be acting sexually provocative, because a woman's body is like a gun in the hands of a child. It's a very dangerous thing. So a young woman, if she's acting in a sexually provocative way, that's a really dangerous thing in a spiritual community. So we need to, Krishna consciousness is a very serious thing. Let's take it seriously. Let's not just use it as a way of come and join ISKCON so I can find a wife or a husband, which many people do. And even I see some people in their relationships with their guru, young women in their relationship with the guru, they've been dissatisfied in relationships and stuff, and they start to act towards their guru in a way which is really inappropriate. They're trying to allure their guru. Sometimes it happens as they succeed. Prabhupada talks about there's a class of women who go to Vrindavan because they're thinking, if I can get a sadhu to father a child, then this will be a very good child, and this child will take me back to Godhead. As they understand the philosophy to some extent. So they go to Vrindavan trying to find sannyasis that they can cause to fall down, so they can have a child who will be a great devotee and deliver them, because they feel inadequacy in their own devotional practices. So that's one side of the story. The other side of the story is that there's men who know that women do this. So they go to Vrindavan, they dress up as sadhus, they behave like sadhus, looking for these women. Yeah? So it's the cheaters and the cheated. Yeah? So we need to be aware of our position. We need to be aware of this wonderful opportunity we have in Krishna consciousness. Don't waste the human form of life simply for, as Rishabh Dev said, simply for the activities that are available to hogs and dogs with each stool. They're engaging, eating, sleeping, mating, defending. They're doing the same thing. Why should we focus on that? That's going to come of its own accord. Is anyone here hungry? You live in a Hare Krishna temple? Is there anyone hungry? No. Huh? Is anyone not getting enough sleep? Huh? Krishna takes care of everything. Eating, sleeping, mating, defending. He takes care of all these things. So why struggle for this? Let the hogs and dogs struggle for these things. And they do. They have to struggle constantly. They fight over it all the time. They fight over their bones. They fight over their partners. We don't need to do that. Just, use the human form of life for what it's meant for.
Medically, the essential difference between hormones. Male hormone and female. There's a difference. That's why the women are very emotional. Srila Prabhupada also once said in the lecture that men have got 36 ounces of brain, and the women have got less. That's all the difference.
And he was challenged one time. He was challenged one time, and he says, "No, my professor, he weighed them." Yeah. He took the brains out and weighed them. Okay. Thank you all so much. Grantaraj, Mad Bhagavatamaki, Samaveta Bhaktavindaki, Shri Prabhupada Ki, Jainita Gopremanandi.